It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
Hit.
No, I guess nothing. Maybe didn't ask you to do it. So we're recording and we're good. Okay. I'm going to start in and then we'll go. I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking with artist, museum curator, and author Gary Hoyle about his new book, Mystery Tusk, Searching for Elephants in the Maine Woods. Gary's search for the truth led him into the woods of northern Maine as he uncovered the truth behind this amazing find. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
This, it's really amazing. I want to start with by just giving you some praise for taking on a book where you also did the illustrations on your own, and the photographs, a lot of them are yours. And you also wrote quite a story about it. What I'm curious about, and I think the listeners would be curious about, so a tusk from what?
Well, it ended up finally once I actually figured out myself where it was from, what it was, and its origin. We finally determined that it was a tusk of a mammoth, but the story, I didn't get involved in the story until about I think it was 1989. When I'd heard about this tusk in a museum collection, and located the tusk, it was actually in a professor's. There was a tusk in a professor's office, and we thought for a while that tusk might have something to do with Maine, because he had determined that a tusk had been found in Scarborough, Maine. The problem was when we finally located where this tusk had come from, two tusks had been put into a crate, and they had been hauled to another museum. And by the time the crate was opened, it was over a decade later. And when it was opened, the labels on the tusks had fallen to the bottom of the crate. One was from Alaska and one was from Scarborough, Maine. And nobody at that time seemed to know which one was which. So we had to spend a lot of time trying to figure that out.
Wow, that's a big distance between Maine and Alaska.
It certainly is.
So it's also, you're looking at two tusks, and they don't, like have any sort of dating on their own. Although you go through a lot of things eventually, we'll talk about that, but you go through a lot to try to have people help you figure out what it is. Why don't we start, the story really starts back, doesn't it, with some people that were just digging in an area.
Yeah, they were actually digging a farm pond, and they eventually came across this tusk in clay. And at first, the guy that was digging this up saw this flash of white in the clay, and he thought it was a big root in the clay, and he thought, this is odd to have a root that far down in the clay. And so he stopped his machine and they went to investigate. And sure enough, they found this tusk that was buried in the clay. and it had seashells around it. And the person that was one of the people was the son of the landowner, and he saved some of the seashells. They tried to get the tusk out of the clay. And at first they tried to do it by hand and they were unsuccessful. And then the fellow running the bucket machine went over with his claw of the bucket and put it underneath the tusk and started to pull it up. Well, in the process, it broke and scattered the ivory across the clay. So they immediately stopped and they got in touch with one of the people at the local newspaper, and she got in touch with the what was then known as the Portland Museum of Natural History in Portland, Maine. And the director of that organization came out and saw the tusk, and at first he thought it was coming from a walrus, because the walrus skulls and tusks have been found in the clay beds in Maine. Not very many of them, but certainly a significant number anyway. And so he thought it might be one of those, but when he got home, he realized that the tusk was much bigger than the normal walrus tusk, and it was also had a curvature to it that was unlikely walrus. So he contacted Harvard University, talked with a scientist there, a paleontologist, and paleontologist took a great interest in what he was describing, and said, "This is no walrus skull. This is from one of the ancient elephants." And so that's when the story started. And this happened in 1959 when they were digging up the digging the pond at the time. And so this was unknown to us. I mean, I and another researcher thought, this must have happened back in the 1800s, because, you know, we've heard nothing about it, that we haven't seen anything in any newspapers. No one we know of has indicated that a tusk was ever found in Scarborough. Fortunately, there was a reporter in Portland, who was doing some cataloging of his newspaper, and that was going to merge. It was the Portland Evening Express, and it was merging with the Portland Press Herald, which still exists. And so he said he'd take a look in his in his records to see if he could find anything on that. And sure enough, I think it was like a week later, all of a sudden we get a report from him that you know, there's a mention of a tusk in 1959, these fellows finding a mastodon tusk. And so immediately, once I heard that, I went the museum at that time. I was at the Maine State Museum. I was a curator there. And immediately I went downstairs to the state library, which was in the same building, and pulled out some old files on newspapers and get to a printer, a microfilm printer, and found that the newspaper article, which talked about the tusk, and there was a photograph on the front page, and it showed the tusk and some pieces of ribs that these fellows had found, and it gave names too. So that really helped so that I could get to the greater Portland directory and find the name Little John and Cash, and those two people were the people that had dug up the remains of this creature. And at the time, you know, there's a number of people named Cash and Little John, so it took me a little bit of time to find out who to call. But when I called the Little John house, I remember I said, I don't know if I have the right Little John. And the lady said to me, well, is it about the tusk? And so I confirmed exactly where I wanted to be. So, and fortunately, Mr. and Mrs. Little John were very helpful. They not only did they show us the shells that were dug up with the tusk, but they also took us, me and another fellow, down to the actual area where they dug the tusk up. So we knew exactly where it had come from. So that was very, very helpful.
You know, that it is so interesting. So were you already in the process of making an exhibit before you found those tusks, or did those tusks kind of form the idea that you wanted to do an exhibition of ancient Maine?
Yeah, we were working on a series of exhibits, actually an exhibit hall of archaeology in Maine, and the head of the hall, our archaeologist Bruce Bork, wanted to have an introductory exhibit that would draw people into that hall, and so he asked if I would get involved with that. I just finished a plant case that had taken me a couple of years to do. Actually, it was a lot of detailed work, but anyway, Bruce knew my skills and wanted me to get involved in it, and so I told him that I would be glad to, you know, see what I could do, and so that's when I called a friend of mine who worked at Maine. The Geological Survey, and named Woody Thompson. I talked with Woody for a while. Woody helped me out in a number of collections, mostly geological collections. And so Woody was listing off a whole number of different things that had been found in the clay beds in Maine, and mostly shells, a few bones of seals, and some walrus skulls. And then, just as an afterthought, he said, there's this tusk that was found, but it's controversial. He said it might be modern, might be ancient, and it supposedly was found in Scarborough. So that's how that all started out. And he told me where he believed the tusk was, hanging on a wall outside of Hal Bourne's office. Harold Bourne's was the head at that time of the Institute of Quaternary Studies, which now is called the Climate Change Institute, so that people have a better understanding of what their research is all about. Right. Anyway, and Hal got interested in my question too. You know, was this thing from Scarborough, or was it from Alaska? And thanks to Mr. Little John and his wife, we found out that we were looking at the wrong tusk, but the tusk was still around, and it happened to be up at the University of Maine in Presque Isle in a little area that they were going to make into a museum up there. So we found the tusk that belonged in Scarborough, and then we eventually got that transferred to the museum, the ownership. And at that point, we could do a radiocarbon test on it. So we sent the radiocarbon testing off, and ivory chips, and they proved that this was an ancient animal. And So that's when we thought, okay, now we got to get serious about this.
Right. And then you're on the, you're on this quest then, right? Because you've got this thing, you've dated it. Wasn't it also helpful that it had been broken? Isn't that part of the story of being able to be sure it was the right one?
Yeah, that's the one, you know, that's where they were trying to get the tusk out of the clay and, right. and the backhoe that they had, pulled on the tusk and stamped it. So, right. when we finally got it to the museum, it was raining ivory. I mean, there was just all kinds of chips that were falling out of it. So we had to be very careful with it. But at the same time, it was easy to get samples to send off to for radiocarbon dating. So it was easy to do. We wanted to prove what it was. I mean, you know, we knew it was ancient, but there were a couple different elephants around at the time. One was called a mastodon, and the mastodon had teeth. Mastodon means breast tooth. So the cusps on the tooth take on these kind of breast forms, and they are actually teeth that are more kind of like somewhat like a deer's tooth, in that they work well for browsing. They're not designed especially well for grazing on grasses, although the animal certainly could, deer do that. So, but it was pretty much specialized for eating browse. Whereas the other ancient elephant that was around, called the mammoth, had a more like a millstone surface on its teeth. And so it was especially adapted to living on grasses and other types of plants, which are known as forbs, which are basically the flowering plants that you see in fields. So anyway, we had two elephants that we had to consider. And so I had no training as to, ancient elephants. So we had to pull in a specialist. And so we got a specialist from the University of Michigan by the name of Dan Fisher. Great guy. He came in and he saw the tusk, did some measurements, studied it, looked at the curvature, and he said, I'm about 60% certain that this is a mammoth. So anyway, here we get information that possibly we were dealing with a mammoth, that we knew we were dealing with an ancient elephant, despite what some of people had alluded to when the tusk was found, that it was actually a modern day elephant. So we had this puzzle, and the only way to really solve the whole puzzle was to go to the site and examine the site, do an excavation. And I had no experience doing that, and I didn't know of anybody in Maine that had an experience doing that. So I eventually signed on to a dinosaur dig out in eastern Montana, out in the Badlands, and spent a couple weeks out there working with those people to understand the proper way of excavating these bones. So that was a great experience for me. At the same time, too, I was in the communication with some people in Canada who are very helpful about the work they were doing on a wet site work, where they were removing bones from an old calcareous bog. So I was dealing with two different specialties that were going on at the time. So needless to say, I learned an awful lot in a short period of time.
Right. And then, and I don't want to reveal too much of the book, but part of it was exciting was then you had that whole huge problem of preserving it. And this was like something unlike anything anybody had preserved before, correct? They had not tried this.
Well, I mean, these are always challenges. And, you know, you always build on other people's experiences. So we had, fortunately, objects conservator who lived fairly close to the museum, about 50 miles away, Ron Harvey. And Ron is an excellent conservator. He actually, at one point in time, was a conservator of the famous fossil Lucy. And he also had done some work for the Vatican, too. So Ron really knew his stuff. And he had been the head of conservation at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And so he had a great experience with natural history collections. So Ron helped us a lot. The Canadian team helped us a lot. Gave us a lot of information, and the team out in the Badlands of Montana were very helpful too. So we got all this knowledge that we could work from, and so that helped me out a great deal. I mean, you know, I didn't have a specialty in any of this stuff, so it was it ended up we did this excavation, and it ended up that we had over 100 people involved in the project, some volunteers and some professional people. And I think they did an amazing job piecing together what happened to this creature. We eventually proved, because we found some old diggings at the site, there was a big pile of earth there, and we were going to move that pile of earth. Well, in the process of moving that pile of earth, bones started falling out of it, and so everybody got excited about that. And so I had this whole team of people that were raking the piles down, and they were finding pieces of bone, and one fellow ended up actually finding a tooth. And that confirmed that we were indeed digging up a mammoth. So we could prove that it was a mammoth. We proved that it was a female mammoth. We were able to prove, thanks to Dan Fisher, that she was about 35 years old when she passed away. And so we get a lot of information on that particular elephant.
How did you know? I'm curious. How did you know it was a female? Because all you've got is bones. So what was the indicator?
Okay, the cup end of the tusk, where the ivory grows from the skull, that area is much deeper in a male mammoth than it is in a female mammoth. So we had a shallow cup, and also the tusk length was about, I think it was 6 feet 8 inches, I believe that's what it was. And usually in males, they're around 10 feet or pretty close to it, some even longer than that. So this was much more typical of a female than
wow.
A male. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that all that ferreting of all the that information out and trying to figure it out, it's just an amazing. I've been talking with Gary Hoyle about his work as a curator and illustrator. This amazing story of hunting for elephants, ancient elephants in Maine. And we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day.
So do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with artist, museum curator, and author Gary Hoyle. Gary, what's really amazing to me, if I go back and look at your book, Mystery Tusk, and the quality of the publication itself, it just feels good in your hand. It was really nicely done. But you did a majority of the illustrations. So are you I know you're an artist, but are you an illustrator as well?
Well, I initially, some of those illustrations were actually on a public television special that was done in Maine many years back. And I mean, I kept the rights to the illustrations. I have the illustrations. But anyway, in that process, they wanted so many illustrations. So I took a couple weeks off from the museum and did nothing but illustrate. It was a marathon event, but it was also good for me because I really enjoyed toward the end of it. I was really feeling good about the quality of what I was producing. But at first I felt very rushed as to, you know, whether I could do this or not, but it turned out okay.
Yeah. I mean, some of the sketches are really, really detailed. I'm looking at one where you've got a field sketch actually of a duck-billed dinosaur's jawbone, which is incredibly detailed. I mean, you down on the teeth and you could tell, you know, where it's worn. It's a great image.
Well, thank you. That was also a great experience. I mean, you know, to be out there in the Badlands of Montana, and a land so alien to me. I remember looking down a canyon, and it was blistering hot, and I was looking down there, and here's this white, looked like snow down there. And my mind just kept. You know, it can't be snow. It can't be snow, but it looked just like snow. but it was a great experience because you know, I encountered different wildlife that I've never encountered. Pack rats. At one point, I was walking along a trail. We were doing a survey of the area, and so we were as we did a survey. We would walk along a shallow canyon, the wall of a shallow canyon, and someone would be just above me and someone would be just below me. And we would work like a survey party. And we would, if anybody encountered bone, they would shout out bone and we'd all stop. And then the director would go up and examine that bone and then go higher to see if they could locate the level at which the bone was eroding out, so that possibly we could end up working on bone bit. But anyway, in the process that particular day, I was just getting ready to jump across this little shallow area, and I looked up ahead of me, and here's this thing in the trail, and I thought, what the heck is that? And then I realized it was a 4-foot rattlesnake that was in the trail.
Oh my goodness!
And So I took this pebble and I just threw it over by him, and all of a sudden that head just snapped around and that black tongue came out, and I decided that he wanted me to take another trail, so I climbed a little higher.
Yeah, I mean that's just a great part of the story. And you know, all of you just having to be careful. You're focused on trying to see something, right? And that can be the most dangerous time because you might not be seeing something else. And so,
we were working in an area known as Makoshika State Park. And that's, I think it was 44,000 acres of land there. And And in the evening, we would, you know, we would take walks, you know, just to relax and all. And so there was a group of women that were walking down one of the camp roads there. And all of a sudden, we hear these screams and these women come running into camp. Well, come to find out, we didn't know this, but the rattlesnakes come up to the edge of the road in the evenings, and they wait for things like jackrabbits or pack rats to
cross the road.
Yeah, exactly. So as they're walking down the road, these snakes come zipping out at them and hit their legs. And of course, that scared everybody. They thought they were going to get bit by these rattlesnakes. 90% of what they apparently do is they don't inflict their venom, but they can scare people, I mean, out of the way, you know. So they're actually looking for the smaller prey. They're not looking to attack people so much. No,
they would waste their valuable venom, you know.
Exactly.
They're smart. Yeah, why would they want to do that? They're not going to consume you, so.
That's exactly right. And but we learned our lesson, so.
Yeah, I guess so.
So very careful while walking.
why I'm so interested in that particular illustration and what you were talking about is, what is the value really of that you get out of doing a journal or field? As you're doing it in the field, you're drawing stuff, you're sketching, you're taking notes, I'm sure. But why is that so important and valuable?
Well, personally, it helps me. It helps me understand things as I sketch them out. The other thing is that in the process of sketching, particularly site work, you're trying to emphasize certain important features within the site, and you might not notice that photographically. So when you're sketching, you have a tendency to emphasize that, maybe that critical area that you're talking about, mm-hmm. or that particular feature that you want to want people to understand. So it's not only a, I guess you could call it a teaching tool for me, but also a teaching tool for people I'm trying to communicate with too.
Yeah. And so you're really in, and this is so different than, obviously you take photographs, but it's so different than that because you can really narrow right down to what you want to focus on in that illustration. And so just like in this, you were really able to detail something without having to figure out how to, you know, extract it from a photo or do something. So it's incredible.
You're right. One particular morning, I took the morning to sketch out the site where we were doing our dig. And I remember working with the clay, and if you take a photograph of that clay, it's really hard to distinguish subtleties in the clay. Mm-hmm. So I was sketching the clay bed, and I would, as I said before, emphasize certain things within that clay bed so that people would get a better understanding of what I was talking about, and I'd get a little better understanding what I was talking about too. So,
wow. And I assume that, did you just sit down to sketch, or were you standing and sketching on, how do you accomplish all that?
Usually I just sit down. I mean, you can do some of that by standing up, but it's always, it's not only more comfortable sitting down, But also, you don't have to think about anything else but sketching. I mean, you know, you don't have to think about your balance or anything else. So.
Right. And then part of what you do within that, you've done these wonderful things that I always like to, you know, talk about intersection of art and science. But, you know, here you are, you're a curator, but you're also an artist, and you're going down, and then you're also now becoming someone who's going to write a book. So you're an author, and you're just going off on these different directions wherever it's taking you, like going on that, you wanted to learn more. How do you actually, you know, get something out of the ground? And all along through this, I get a sense through the book, all along, this is chronicling you learning as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think my whole life has been a learning experience. I mean, I don't know if any other way of putting it, but I really feel like I've been blessed to enjoy all these things that I've been doing over the many, many years that I've worked on different projects. I started out thinking that probably I would be a teacher, but I always had a great burning desire to work in a museum. And I was fortunate at one time when I was very young to actually sculpt some turtles for the old Maine State Museum. So,
interesting.
I think that along with other things that I've done over the years was what kind of got me into museum work to begin with. And, I was at the Maine State Museum for 28 years, and I worked with a very, very fine preparator and background painter from the American Museum of Natural History in New York. So I learned a tremendous amount from him, Fred Shearer. He was great, great teacher, great guy.
So what background did you have to get you going into the museum world? I'm always interested in how people get into there. So what did you study?
Well, my father worked in a shoe factory. My mother was, stayed at home, worked, in the house. And so I always had an interest in natural history. And we lived about a football field's length from an old estate with about 1,500 acres there, and I could travel through the fields and the forests there and learn so much, and I was always getting guidebooks to learn a lot of things about plants and animals, and I even had my own little neighborhood in the museum that I had for the kids in the neighborhood, and so that really got me going into wanting to learn more about museums and natural history museums in particular. So that probably started the flame inside me. Now I never knew if I would ever get to work for a museum, but I taught high school chemistry for a couple years, and then I taught at the university, the labs there. Not having an advanced degree and teaching the labs is kind of like being the assistant to the janitor. So I thought, well, I should go back and get my master's. So I went to graduate school, and I was unhappy because I felt like I was getting pushed into laboratory work, and I really didn't want to go that route. I mean, art meant a lot to me, you know. So I eventually just left graduate school and ended up working with a house painting crew, and so I was painting houses there for a while. Every year over a 5-year period, I would go into the Maine State Museum, and I would apply or seek out the possibility of a job there. And so they knew of me. They just basically were telling me that, you know, we don't have anything that you would qualify for and all. Well, then while I was painting a house, all of a sudden somebody comes out of one of these houses and said, "One of you people, Gary Hoyle?" And I said, "I am." I said, "Well, the Maine State Museum is trying to get in touch with you, and they want you to come over for an interview." So sure enough, I came over in my paint clothes, and I was interviewed, and they liked what they heard. So I was hired and started work as an exhibits artist, and get my training from Fred Shearer, and so it all fell in my lap, really.
So your art training came through the work, right? I mean, you were passionate about art.
Oh, absolutely.
But then you get into the museum job, you have to do it, and there you are.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we started right out with the wildlife exhibits, and so I mean, that was like perfect for me.
Yeah.
But here I was learning how to make rocks and trees and plants and small animals to put in these exhibits, and it was like, you know, I wasn't going to work, I was going to play, you know. I mean, it was just a wonderful experience. It really was.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that parallels me some in you know, there was a time, it doesn't happen as much anymore, but there was a time that you could do like you did, or I did. I just moved from elementary teaching into, you know, working in a children's museum, and then got into science as a part of that in there, and learned how to do exhibit design. I already had an art degree too. But what is interesting to me is now I don't think I could have gotten the same job.
Oh, I couldn't have either.
You know, it's different. It's become, you know, almost, we talk about grade inflation or degree inflation, and that sort of has happened. But there was no such thing for either a children's museum or even a natural history museum as museum studies. We did that just wasn't a program, unless you were going to be an administrator. There wasn't anything to prepare you for what you did, which is curating and building an exhibit. And everything was a one-off. So I can feel your passion, and I can hear your excitement, because you walk into this and you got to create everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as I said, you know, when I was a kid, I used to do this little museum thing for myself, and here I was just, I was a big boy, and now I was.
Now you know, have a museum.
Right into it. Yeah, right into it. So
yeah, I love the fact that you're an educator. You know, all you bring all those little talents together, and it just had to be. I know what it felt like for me, but it had to be for you just a thrill. But you know, it's day-to-day work, but it is fun work. And, so it's incredible to imagine, you know, here's this call, you're painting a house, is one of you Gary? And then you have an interview and you're in your paint clothes. I mean, it's just, that's another part of a classic story to that. You said you learned a lot from people that were there in the museum. Did you do a lot of going to other museums as well to see how they illustrated or how they set up an exhibit? Was that part of what you got to do too?
No, I did not. You know, once I met Fred and was working with Fred, I mean, you know, top of the line. So I didn't get to other museums until later in life, where I ended up working outside of the museum once in a while, like on weekends and evenings for other museums. I would do some projects for them. So
that's great.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah, I mean, so you had this wonderful training ground right there built in. And
well, you know, the other thing is that the designer, the exhibit designer, Al Borghese, Al every now and then would challenge me with things. He would, not just me, but other people too, but he would come up and say, you know, I want to do an ice harvesting exhibit. Do you think you can make iced, you know? And so I said, I would say, well, you know, give me a few weeks and I'll let you know, you know? So I would go down in my lab and I would start playing around with various materials and see if I could come up with something that worked. And sure, in that case, I did come up with something that worked. And actually in the future after that, I was actually approached, and it's a long story, so I'll make it short, by Lawrence Rockefeller, who was developing a museum in Woodstock, Vermont. And he wanted to see the types of work that I did. And then, like about 2 weeks later, all of a sudden, I got this offer to work with them on the Billings Farm Museum and do an ice harvesting exhibit for them and a number of other things, which worked out really well. It was a fun series of exhibits.
Yeah. That's amazing. I really like when you just described, you went in your lab and then you just started, you know, playing around with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that was not unusual for me. As I told you before I got into the mammoth thing, I had just finished an exhibit that had taken me 2 years to create of it was a Native American edible plants case. And I had about 100 different parts of plants. I think it was like about 50 different plants and 100 different things like berries and pieces of the plants and all that were on exhibit. I was given enough time so that I could test a lot of different things, materials, right. And a lot of these were waxes, for instance, where you know, you think of like white beeswax, you know, you got to color it up to make it look like something that you can use in a mold to create a cast of maybe crab apples or, you know, raspberries or something like that. But some nuts and some berries are quite opaque looking. So others are more translucent. So not only do you have to deal with color, but you have to deal with the opacity and the translucency of the paint too. So that was a real challenge for me, and a great education though also. Fortunately, there was Fred had given me some good information on waxes, but I get a lot of good information by a fellow who had just in the process of retiring from the Boston Museum of Science. And I've forgotten his name right now, but anyway, he was very helpful because he had done some wax work himself. And out of all that, I ended up doing a project for the Chicago Field Museum. And that had to do with waxes too. So not very many people that are working with waxes anymore.
That's just, yeah, probably because they can work with polymers now.
Right.
But I just think that those are just great stories. So just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit works with artists and scientists and the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore at home, part of what Gary and I have been talking about today, in your own settings and with your own family, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with Gary Hoyle, who has crafted a really wonderful mystery story in a beautifully illustrated new book called Mystery Tusk, Searching for Elephants in the Maine Woods. And I encourage you to get a copy. It's just a wonderful read for you and at that. Gary, I know that a couple times when I've been tried to contact you, you're off somewhere or far away, or at least it feels like far away from things. What, now that you're retired and you're there, you're not ever really retired, but when you're out there, what's your life like now?
Well, I live on an island. I'm 6 miles out to sea, and it's pretty quiet this time of year, especially. In the summer, it's we probably have about 1,000 people out here. In this time of year, it contracts to about 350. So it's quiet. The nice thing about it is that I can spend time in the studio and just play and come up with different things that kind of intrigue me. So I've been recently working on something where I float ink, it's actually oil color, on a surface of water, and then I push a canvas down and pick up that print. And then from that print, I have to let it set for at least a week to dry. So while that's drying, I quite often will walk by and say, well, how does that inspire me? And every now and then I think, I know what I got to do. And so I'll start adding color to certain parts of this and come up with some kind of a unique pitches that I probably would not normally come up with. My next door neighbor is a poet, and he actually teaches creative writing for a college in New York State and online. And so he and I get together once in a while, and I'll give him a painting. And then he'll write a poem about it. And then sometimes he'll bring the poem back. And I think, hey, that inspires me to do another kind of painting. So that's helpful as far as inspirations go. So, yeah.
Wow. I just love that. And so are you fairly far up in Maine then, on the coast of Maine?
If you know where Bar Harbor is.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, that's on Mount Desert Island. We're on the other side of the other, I guess you'd call it the southeast side of that island. If you look 6 miles out to sea, that's where I am. It's called Swan's Island.
And so then you come back and forth by ferry? Is that?
Yes. I got a beautiful view of Mount Desert Island. I can see Cadillac Mountain out there and all the other.
Wow.
Mountains. Thanks to my neighbors. I don't have any shoreline myself, but I have there's a 15-acre field across the road from me. I have a John Deere tractor with a bush hog on it. And so I cut that 15 acres every year to keep it open and never charge my neighbors anything.
You can just see then. You can see. That's great.
Yeah.
And I just think it's wonderful that you're still out, you're out in nature, you're still doing things you love. I love that you're experimenting with a new technique for you. And that idea of seeing what comes in something, right? That has to be a part of how you've been looking at things all along. I mean, even though it's kind of a new artwork, but it's you looking at something and being inspired and seeing something that others don't.
I think I do think that artists and scientists, a curious people. And I think to keep that curiosity up, you have to look at the world in a way that you want to know more. You want to, you know, you travel down these different avenues, because if you don't, you just can feel a stagnation, and so you just feel that you have to push yourself to investigate certain things. And when you push yourself to investigate things, all of a sudden things start to open up, and you realize that, wait, you know, this really is kind of fun. So, yeah, I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're an educator, and I'm an educator, when I think about the gift that we might want to have youth today have, it would be that curiosity, wouldn't it, Gary?
Absolutely. You get to maintain that, because when you get, I mean, I'm going to be 78 years old in a few weeks. And, you know, when you get to be old, you're retired, you know, I mean, you don't have that drive or that push behind you to get to a job or do certain things. And you have to find your own inspiration, your own road to staying young, actually. You know, because your mind, I do believe that your mind stays young if you pursue these things that inspire you.
Yeah, and keep creating, right? I mean,
absolutely.
And I agree with you. I think, you know, age is, there are things that we have that we can't control, aches and pains, but we can control how we feel, how old we feel. And that's what you're talking about. And yep. by keeping things alive in terms of your mind and eyes and your seeing and your eyes trying to create, you are keeping yourself very young. And I think that's wonderful.
And also you feel like you're contributing to society too. You know, it's not just a selfish thing.
Right. I agree so much. You know, this has been really wonderful. I hate to cut it off, and but we've come to the end. I want to thank you so much, Gary. I've been talking to Gary Hoyle about his search for truth in the woods of Northern Maine, but also his own life as an artist and curator, and now as a person who just keeps creating as we go forward. I hope that you will pick up a copy of his book, Mystery Tusk, Searching for Elephants in the Maine Woods. I was totally thrilled to read it. It's a perfect thing to read this time of year, I think, and I think you all will enjoy it. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.